Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Over the past few years, as we've become increasingly aware of police killings of African Americans and many other tragic injustices, one thing has become supremely clear. If you're white, the era of lynching, of Jim Crow, official racism, all of it seems like it happened a long time ago in the bad old pre-civil rights days. But if you're black, those events seem somehow as if they took place much more recently, maybe well within your own lifetime. Brian Stevenson is a lawyer and civil rights activist who would like to close the gap between white and black memory. Stevenson is in his mid-50s, but he began school in a segregated classroom. He went on to found a group called the Equal Justice Initiative, and the group has published an original study of lynching. For Stevenson, the history of lynching is also deeply personal.
I don't think there's any question that it did shape me. I mean, my grandfather talked about hiding behind an alley building when a lynching took place in the community. Obviously, a lynching of a black man made it not safe for any black person to be in the area. And he talked about hiding from people that he knew, people that he had played with, his so-called friends, because he didn't feel like if he presented himself in that moment that he would be safe. And we had all these rules. You know, you couldn't go into town. I did not grow up a free person in this nation. I couldn't go to the places I really wanted to go. I loved the beach, but the beach was segregated. I wanted to go to the big, bright public school that had the nice playground and the big baseball diamond. I wanted to play baseball. I wasn't free to do that. And that absence of freedom shaped my worldview. What it meant to be free was much more burdensome, much more consequential in terms of opportunities. And I have no doubt that that shaped my worldview.
Brian, what did you and your researchers discover about the nature of and the scope of lynching that historians had not discovered? My understanding is that the sum total of it went up by some significant percentage.
I mean, we first documented hundreds of more lynchings that had been documented before, and we had a different approach. We went into these communities. We dug through courthouses and newspaper archives. It took 5 years, but for us, it wasn't an academic project. We really wanted to understand the history of these communities, and as a result of that, we were able to identify hundreds more lynchings that had been previously identified.
But I guess the question is then, why you? In other words, we have a mountain of scholarship about the slave trade, about Reconstruction, about lynching. What can you add? How do you go about adding to the sum total of knowledge and consciousness of the most vexed part of American history?
You know, we've been asking ourselves that as well. I mean, I think we are in a place where we do not have a healthy narrative about our history. And we're doing it because we frankly don't see any consciousness about these problems. We want to offer some guidance about the ways in which we think we need to think differently about this history.
And how do you do that?
Well, I think it begins, first of all, by rebutting the false narratives. I live in Montgomery, Alabama. It is a community that loves talking about mid-19th century history. If you come to Montgomery, we have 59 markers and monuments to the Confederacy. Our two largest high schools are Robert E. Lee High and Jefferson Davis High. They're both 99% black. Alabama's a state where Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. We don't even have Martin Luther King Day. We have Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. We are very comfortable invoking these images, this history, which ought to be painful, shameful. So we've been saying we've got to change that. We've got to start talking about slavery. There was nothing here really to point people's attention to this legacy, when in fact Montgomery was one of the most prominent slave trading spaces in America. So we put out a report that documented the horrors of slavery. We talked about how enslaved people were crime victims. They were kidnapped. They were abducted. And we began telling those stories. And then we began erecting markers in downtown Montgomery that forced people to think about the fact that this is a
space.
So
in a way, those markers are competitors for the names of streets, the names of high schools that are named for Confederate quote-unquote heroes.
Yes. I think we're trying to complicate the narrative that this is a place where you can only celebrate the mid-19th century, that there is this place of great pride and achievement. And there are things about which we can be proud and things about which we can say there have been achievements, but there are also things about which there should be shame. I believe we need to talk about the shame of slavery. We need to talk about the shadows that still haunt us. The great evil of American slavery was not involuntary servitude and forced labor. I think the great evil of American slavery was the ideology of white supremacy.
I've got to think that a lot of people hearing this say, well, wait a minute. There was this thing called the Civil Rights Movement and Brown versus Board of Education and a whole series of voting rights acts and all the rest. Didn't we solve that problem? Why are we looking back to lynching in a way that's not just historical but as a present tense problem and consciousness?
Yeah, I think if we don't understand the depth of the problem, we're going to misperceive the quality of the solution. I think we've made a mistake by putting too much attention to the great achievements of African Americans, Rosa Parks, Dr. King, absolutely extraordinary what they did. But we haven't paid any attention to all of those white people, those governors, those policymakers, those teachers, clergy, who kept shouting segregation forever. When did they stop believing segregation forever? Can we point to a time? If you understand the great threat to be this ideology of white supremacy, this narrative of racial difference, you'd have no reason to believe that that construct, that threat, has been overcome. And in fact, you know, I think the problem of our current history is that the burden has always been on people of color to prove that racism exists, when in fact, after 400 years, after narratives of racial difference, after enslavement and lynching and segregation, the question ought to be, who bears the burden? And I think in places like Alabama and South Carolina and Minnesota and New York, the burden ought to be on the rest of the society to prove that we are no longer trying to maintain this narrative of racial difference. We are committed to deconstructing white supremacy. And I've seen very little evidence of that kind of commitment, particularly at the government and national level.
Brian, when you see John Lewis, a great civil rights hero, embracing and accepting the apology of a Klansman who beat him as a young man, when you see the relatives of people in Charleston, South Carolina, forgiving the murder of their child or spouse, do you think that's counterproductive in some way to the project that you're talking about?
Oh, no. I think it's an essential example of the project that we're talking about. I mean, we ultimately want everyone in the nation to do that. I think when the chief of police from Montgomery apologizes to John Lewis, he is modeling exactly what should happen. When we put up markers at lynching sites, which is our plan over the next couple of years, I want the police chief, I want the sheriff from those communities to be there with us. And I think if that sheriff or that police chief says to the black community, I want to apologize because people wearing my uniform throughout most of the 20th century failed to protect you. They allowed you to be lynched and victimized and assaulted and beat up. And I want to say I'm sorry, and I now want to commit to you that people wearing my uniform are not going to tolerate that kind of victimization. We are going to be here to protect you.
And you don't think that, you don't think those law enforcement officials and mayors throughout those 12 states in the South would say, well, you know, I'm too young to remember lynching. I was born after the Voting Rights Act. You'd say, I'm okay. Why are you bothering me with this?
Well, because at least for the police chiefs and the sheriffs, they are still wearing the same uniform that terrorized and traumatized people. And they know they don't have strong and positive relationships with many people of color. There is a distrust. And I think one of the things you can do is own up to that history, begin to understand how that history was developed, and what would it cost them to say, I am sorry that people wearing this uniform 50, 80, 100 years ago failed to protect you? Why not do that?
You're suggesting a process that South Africa went through after the fall of apartheid, the truth and reconciliation process. How would a truth and reconciliation process look in the United States?
It would look a lot like what you see in Germany. You go to Berlin, Germany, you can't go 100 meters without seeing a marker or a stone that's been placed next to the home of a Jewish family that was abducted during the Holocaust. The Germans actually want you to go to Auschwitz and reflect soberly on that history. You come to this country, you can't find anywhere where we deal honestly with the legacy of slavery.
But let's note the moment we're in. One of the things that's come out of this conversation about race and history, whether it's about the history of housing policy in northern cities or lynching in the South, is the idea of reparations. Ta-Nehisi Coates is only the most recent person to put a hard light on what this is and what it might be. In your view, what's the proper view of reparations?
Well, I do think we have to recover from all the damage that has been done. And not only do we have to do that to help people who have been victimized by this history, but those people who benefited from this history have to recover as well. And it's like, you know, if I knock someone down and injure them, I have to, in order to maintain my own peace quotient, make clear to them that I didn't intend to hurt them. I can't really be at peace if I'm a decent human being and not do everything that's possible to help that person recover if I'm responsible for their injury. It's just what decency requires. Mm. It's what my own progress requires. And that's the way I think about reparations. And so instead of passing the Voting Rights Act and then immediately trying to deconstruct it, repeal it, bar its implementation, which is what happened in the South, we should have been saying, no, what else can we do? You know, if we had been really focused in the 1960s, we would have been saying to repair the damage of disenfranchisement, we're going to have different policies for black people. We're going to say every black person is automatically registered to vote mm-hmm. when they turn 18. And then we're going to say we're going to allow black people to vote at any voting precinct they go to. Different set of rules because we want to express our rejection of disenfranchisement against African Americans. We're going to actually go to the homes of black people and get their votes. We're going to allow black people to go to public state universities at half the price of everybody else because we've denied them admission wrongfully for decades. We're going to do these things that are reparational because we have to help these communities recover. And that's the way we need to be thinking about reparations. You say the word reparations now, people immediately get tense and upset and angry because they're afraid they're going to have to give up something that they believe belongs to them. They're not looking to recover because they don't have enough shame or awareness to appreciate that it'll be as good for them as it will be for the alleged beneficiaries of that repair.
Or the reparation is understood as a, and I'm using air quotes around this, the word handout, a discrete amount of money to each and every African American.
It's one of the problems in America. We're just so dominated by money. We think that money is the only thing that can solve problems. Oh, reparations means giving a few dollars to every person of color. And I just think that's so misguided. You know, when I give talks, I say this thing. I say I don't believe the opposite of poverty is wealth. I believe the opposite of poverty is justice. We need to be thinking, what would be just to recover from all of these injuries, all of these barriers that we have constructed? I do think it's an unhealthy retort to say, oh, it's just about money. That's not what it's about. It's about helping a society create a future where we're no longer burdened by this history. We're as burdened in 2016 as we were in 1916. These young men of color that are being shot and killed by the police, the obstacles that you have to overcome, haven't become that much easier to overcome because we haven't done enough to confront the narratives behind them. And so in that respect, we've got to reframe what it means to repair these problems. We're in this place because we haven't done this important work of owning up to our history, of telling the truth about our history. We can't insist on truth and reconciliation, but if we insist on truth, I think good people will feel the need to reconcile themselves to the pain and anguish of our past by committing to a new future. And I don't think that's really happened yet. Everybody thinks that if they were alive during the time of slavery, they would be abolitionists. If they were alive during the time of lynching, they'd be fighting to end it. If they were alive in the 50s and 60s, they'd be marching with Dr. King. Well, everyone is alive today who's hearing my voice during a time when there are threats to racial justice, where presumptions of dangerousness and guilt prevail. And we want them to recognize the connection between these eras and then do something. That's what we hope we can create.
Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative.